She lifted a hand to her mouth and gave a strangled little laugh. When she caught her breath, she said, "Ever since the mayor came to us, he and Chivalry have argued about that. I'll tell him." She took two steps away from me and repeated, "I'll tell him." Then she whirled and was gone. I stood for a moment feeling bereft. Then a sad smile spread over my face. I sat down on the bench and looked out over the woman's garden. It was summer, and the air was rich with the fragrance of both herbs and blossoms, and yet the scent of my daughter's hair was still in my nostrils, and I savoured it. I stared into the distance over the top of the lilac tree and wondered. It was going to take me longer to get to know my daughter than I had thought. Perhaps there would never be a good time to tell her that I was her father. That piece of information did not seem as important as it once had. Instead, it seemed more important that I find a way to come into their lives without causing pain or discord. It wasn't going to be easy, but I would do it, somehow. I must have fallen asleep there. When I awoke, it was late afternoon. For a moment, I could not recall where I was, only that I was happy. That was such a rare sensation for me that I lay there, looking up at blue sky through green leaves. Then I became aware that my back was stiff from sleeping on a stone bench, and in the following instant that I had planned to take food and wine back to the Fool today. Well, it was not too late for that, I told myself. I rose and stretched and rolled the kinks out of my neck and shoulders. The pathway back to the kitchen led through the herb gardens. At that time of year, lavender and dill and fennel grow tall, and this year they seemed even taller than usual. I heard one woman say querulously to another,
"Just see how they've let the gardens go! Disgraceful! Pull up that weed, if you can reach it!"
Then, as I stepped into view, I recognised Lacey's voice as she said,
"I don't think that's a weed, dear heart. I think it's a marigold. Well, it's too late now, whatever it was. You've got it up, roots and all. Give it to me, and I'll throw it in the bushes where no one will find it."
And there they were, two dear old ladies. Patience in a summer gown and hat that had probably last seen the light of day when my father was king-in-waiting. Lacey, as ever, was dressed in the simple robe of a serving-woman. Patience carried her slippers in one hand and the torn-out marigold in the other. She looked at me near-sightedly. Perhaps she saw no more than the blue of a guard's uniform as she declared to me sternly,
"Well, it didn't belong there."
She shook the offending plant at me.
"That's what a weed is, young man, a plant growing in the wrong place. So you needn't stare at me so. Didn't your mother teach you any manners?"
"Oh, dear, Ada of the Fields,"
Lacey exclaimed. I thought I might still be able to retreat, but then Lacey, stolid, solid Lacey, turned slowly and fainted dead away into the lavender.
"Whatever are you doing, dear? Did you lose something?"
Patience exclaimed, peering at her. And then, when she perceived Lacey was supine and unmoving, she turned on me, asking in outrage,
"See what you've done now? Frightened the poor old woman to death, you have. Well, don't stand there, you simpleton. Pluck her out of the lavender before she crushes it completely."
Yes, ma'am, I said, and stooping, I lifted her. Lacey had always been a hearty woman, and age had not dwindled her. Nonetheless, I managed to raise her, and even carried her to a shady spot before I set her down on the grass there. Patience had followed us, muttering and shaking her head over how clumsy I was.
"Faints with the drop of a hat, she does now. Poor old dear. Do you feel better now?"
She eased herself down beside her companion and patted her hand. Lacey's eyes fluttered. "I'll fetch some water, shall I?"
"Yes, and hurry. And don't even think of running off, young man. This is all you're doing, you know."
I ran to the kitchens for a cup and filled it at the well on my way back. By the time I got there, Lacey was sitting up and Lady Patience was fanning her old servant, alternately scolding and sympathising.
"And you know as well as I do how the eyes play tricks on us at our age. Why, only last week I tried to shoo my wrap off the table, thinking it was the cat. It was the way it was curled, you know."
"My lady, no. Look well. It is him, or his ghost. He looks just as his father looked at that age. Look at him do.
I kept my eyes down as I knelt by her and offered her the cup. A bit of water, ma'am, and I'm sure you'll feel better. It was most likely the heat. Then, as Lacey took the cup from me, Patience reached across her to seize my chin in her hand.
Look at me, young man. Look at me, I said.
And then, as she leaned closer and closer to me, she exclaimed,
"My chivalry never had a nose like that."
But his eyes do remind me.
Oh, oh, my son! My son! It cannot be! It cannot be!
She let go of me and sat back. Lacey offered her the cup of water, and Patience took it absently. She drank from it, and turning to Lacey, said calmly,
"He wouldn't dare. He wouldn't have."
Lacey still stared at me.
"You heard the rumours, same as me, my lady, and that witted minstrel sang us the song about the dragons and how the witted bastard rose from the grave to serve his king."
"He wouldn't," Patience repeated. She stared at me, and my tongue was frozen to the roof of my mouth. Then,
"Help me up, young man. And Lacey, too, she has the fainting spells these days. Eating too much fish is what I think brings them on, and river fish at that makes her wobbly, so you'll just see us back to our chambers, won't you?"
"Yes, ma'am. I'll be happy to."
"I dare say you'll be happy to. Until we get you behind closed doors. Take her arm, now, and help her along."
But that was easier said than done, for Patience clung to my other arm as if a river might sweep her away if she let go. Lacey was, in truth, swaying as she walked, and I felt very bad indeed to have given her such a shock. Neither one of them said another word to me, though twice Patience pointed out caterpillars on the roses and said they were never tolerated in the old days. Once inside, we still had a long walk through the great hall, and then up the wide stairs. I was grateful that it was only one flight, for Patience muttered nasty words as she mastered each riser, and Lacey's knees cracked alarmingly. We went down the hall, and Patience waved at a door for me. It was one of the best chambers in Buckkeep, and it pleased me more than I could say that Queen Cutrican had accorded her this respect. Lady Patience's travelling trunk was already open in the middle of the room, and a hat was already perched on the mantel. Cutrican had even recalled that Lady Patience preferred to dine in her chambers, for a small table and two chairs had been placed in the fall of sunlight from the deep-set window. I saw each of them to a chair, and when they were seated asked them if there was anything else I could bring them.
16 years!
Patience snapped.
"You can fetch me 16 years! Shut that door! I don't suppose it would be wise for this to be gossip all over Buckkeep. 16 years, and not a peep, not a hint. Tom, Tom, whatever were you thinking?"
"More likely not thinking at all,"
Lacey suggested, looking at me with martyred eyes. That stung, for always when I had been a boy and in trouble with Patience, Lacey had taken my part. She seemed to have recovered well from her faint. There were spots of colour on her cheeks. She ponderously rose from her chair and went into the adjoining room. In a few moments she returned with 3 teacups and a bottle of brandy on a little tray. She set it down on the small table between them, and I winced at the sight of her lumpy knuckles and gnarled fingers. Age had crippled those nimble hands that once had tatted lace by the hour.
"I suppose we could all do with a bit of this. Not that you deserve any," she said coldly. "That was quite a fright you gave me in the garden. Not to mention years of grief."
16 years,
Patience clarified, in case I had managed to forget in the last few moments. Then, turning to Lacey, she said,
"I told you he wasn't dead. When we prepared his body to bury him, even then, washing his cold legs, I told you he couldn't be dead. I don't know how I knew it, but I knew it. And I was right." "He was dead,"
Lacey insisted.
"My lady, he had not breath to fog a bit of glass, nor a single thump of his heart. He was dead."
She pointed a finger at me. It shook slightly.
"And now you are not. You had best have a good explanation for this, young man."
It was Burrick's idea.
I began, and before I could say another word, Patience threw up her hands in the air, crying,
"Oh, I should have guessed that man would be at the bottom of this. That's your girl he has been raising all these years, isn't it? 3 years after we'd buried you, we heard a rumour. That tinker, Cottlesby, that sells such nice needles, he told us he had seen Molly in, oh, some town, with a little girl at her side. I thought to myself then, how old? For I said to Lacey, when Molly left my service so abruptly, that she puked and slept like a woman with child. Then she was gone before I could even offer to help her with the babe. Your daughter. My grandchild. Then, later, I heard that Burrick had gone with her, and when I asked about, he was claiming all the children as his own. Well, I might have known. I might have known."
I had not been prepared for Patience to be quite so well informed. I should have been. In the days after my death, she had run Buckkeep Castle and developed a substantial network of folk who reported to her. "I think I could do with some brandy," I said quietly. I reached for the decanter, but Patience slapped my hand away.
"I'll do it," she exclaimed crossly. "Do you think you can pretend to be dead and vanish from my life for 16 years and then walk in and pour yourself some of my good brandy? Insolence!"
She got it open, but when she tried to pour, her hand shook so wildly that she threatened to deluge the table. I took it from her as she began to gasp and poured some into our cups. By the time I set the bottle down, she was sobbing. Her hair, never tidy for long, had half fallen down. When had so much grey come into it? I knelt down before her and forced myself to look up into her faded eyes. She covered her face with her hands and sobbed harder. Cautiously, I reached up and tugged her hands from her face. "Please, believe me. It was never by choice, Mother. If I could have come back to you without putting the people I loved at risk, I would have. You know that. And the way you prepared my body for burial may have saved my life. Thank you."
"A fine time to call me Mother after all these years,"
she sniffed, then added,
"And what would Burrick have known about anything unless it had 4 legs and hooves?"
But she put her tear-wet hands on my cheeks and drew me forward to kiss me on the brow. She sat back and looked down at me severely. The tip of her nose was very pink.
"I'll have to forgive you now. Ada knows I may drop dead tomorrow, and angry as I am with you, I still would not wish you to walk about the rest of your life regretting that I had died before I forgave you. But that does not mean I'm going to stop being angry with you, nor that Lacey has to stop being angry with you. You deserve it."
She sniffed loudly. Lacey passed her a handkerchief. The old serving woman's face rebuked me as she took her seat at the table. More clearly than ever, I saw how the years together had erased the lines between lady and maid. "Yes, I do."
"Well, get up. I've no desire to get a crick in my neck staring at you down there. Why on earth are you dressed as a guardsman? And why have you been so foolish as to come back to Buckkeep Castle? Don't you know there are still people who would love to see you dead? You are not safe here, Tom. When I return to Tradeford, you shall come with me. Perhaps I can pass you off as a gardener, or a wayward cousin's son. Not that I shall allow you to touch my plants. You know nothing about gardens and flowers."
I came to my feet slowly, and could not resist saying, "I could help with the weeding. I know what a marigold looks like, even when it isn't in flower."
"There. You see, Lacey, I forgive him, and the next word out of his mouth is to mock me."
Then she covered her mouth suddenly, as if to suppress another sob. The tendons and blue veins stood out on the back of her hand. Behind it she drew a sharp breath, and then said,
"I think I'll have my brandy now."
She lifted her cup and sipped from it. She glanced at me over the brim, and more tears suddenly spilled. She set the cup down hastily, shaking her head.
"You're here, and alive. I don't know what I've got to weep about. Except 16 years and a grandchild lost to me forever. How could you, you wretch? Account for them. Account for yourself and what you've been doing that was so very important you couldn't come home to us."
And suddenly all the very good reasons I'd had for not going to her seemed trivial. I could have found a way. I heard myself say aloud, "If I hadn't given my pain to the stone dragon, I think I would have found a way, however risky."
Maybe you have to keep your pain and loss to know that you can survive whatever life deals you. Perhaps without putting your pain in its place in your life, you become something of a coward. She slapped the table in front of her, then exclaimed in pain at her stinging fingers.
I didn't want a moral lecture. I wanted an accounting, with no excuses.
I've never forgotten the apples you threw to me through the bars of my cell. You and Lacey were incredibly brave to come to me in the dungeons, and to take my part when few others dared to.
Stop it!
She hissed indignantly, as her eyes filled with tears again.
Is this how you get your pleasure these days? Making old ladies weep over you?
I don't mean to.
Then tell me what happened to you, from the last time I saw you.
My lady, I would love to, and I will, I promise, but when I encountered you, I was on a pressing errand of my own, one that I should complete before I lose the daylight. Let me go, and I promise that I'll be back tomorrow and give a full accounting.
No, of course not. What errand?
You recall my friend, the fool. He has fallen ill. I need to take him some herbs to ease him, and food and wine.
That pasty-faced lad? He was never a healthy child. Ate too much fish, if you ask me. That will do that to you.
I'll tell him, but I need to go see him.
When did you last see him?
Yesterday.
Well, it has been 16 long years since you've seen me. He can wait his turn.
But he is not well.
She clashed her teacup as she set it down on the saucer.
Neither am I,
she exclaimed, and fresh tears began to well. Lacey came to pat her shoulders. Over Patience's head, she said to me,
She is not always rational, especially when she is tired. We only arrived this morning. I told her that she should rest, but she wanted a bit of air in the gardens.
And what, pray, is irrational about that?
Patience demanded.
Nothing, I said hastily. Nothing at all. Come, I've an idea. Lie down on your bed, and I shall sit beside you where you are comfortable, and begin my tale. And if you drowse off, I shall quietly take my leave and come back to continue it tomorrow. For 16 years cannot be told in an hour, or even in a day.
It will take 16 years to tell 16 years,
Patience told me sternly.
Help me up, then. I'm stiff from travelling, you know.
I gave her my arm, and she leaned on it as I escorted her to her bed. She groaned as she sat down on it, and as the feather bed gave beneath her, she muttered,
Much too soft. I'll never be able to sleep on this. Do they think I'm a hen setting in a nest?
Then, as she lay back and I helped her lift her feet onto the bed, she said,
You've quite ruined my surprise, you know. Here I was, all set to summon a grandchild to me and reveal to her that she was well born of noble blood and pass on to her keepsakes of her father's. Oh, help me take my shoes off. When did my feet get so far away from my hands?
You don't have your shoes on. I think you left your slippers in the garden.
And whose fault is that, startling us that way? It's a wonder I didn't forget my head down there.
I nodded, noting but not commenting that her stockings didn't match. Patience had never cared much for detail. What sort of keepsakes? I asked.
It scarcely matters now. As you are alive, I intend to keep them.
What were they? I asked, intensely curious.
Oh, a painting you gave me, don't you know? And when you were dead, I took a lock of your hair. I've worn it in a locket ever since.
While I was speechless, she leaned up on an elbow.
Lacey, come have a lie down for a bit. You know I don't like you to be too far away if I need you. Your hearing isn't what it used to be.
To me, she confided.
They've given her a narrow little bed in a closet of a room. Fine if your maid is a slip of a girl, but hardly appropriate for a mature woman.
Lacey!
I'm right here, dearie. You needn't shout.
The old serving woman came round to the other side of the bed. She looked a bit uncomfortable at the prospect of lying down in front of me, as if I might think it improper that she should share a lady's bed. It made perfect sense to me.
I am tired,
she admitted as she sat down. She had brought a shawl, and she spread it over Patience's legs. I brought a chair to the edge of the bed and sat down backwards on it. Where should I begin? I asked her.
Begin by sitting on that chair properly.
And after I had corrected that, she said,
Don't tell me what that vile pretender did to you to kill you. I saw enough of it on your body, and I could not bear it then. Tell me instead how you survived.
I thought briefly, considering. You know I am witted.
I thought you might be,
she conceded. She yawned.
And?
And so I launched into my tale. I told her of seeking refuge in my wolf and how Burrick and Chade had called me back to my body. I told her of my slow recovery and of Chade's visit. I thought she had drowsed off then, but when I tried to rise, her eyes flew open.
Sit down,
she commanded me, and when I had done so, she took my hand as if to keep me from creeping away.
I'm listening. Go on.
I told her of Burrick leaving and of the Forged Ones. I explained to her how Burrick had come to believe I had died there, and returned to Molly to protect her and the child she carried. I told her of my long journey from Buck to Tradeford, and of Regal's King's Circle there. She opened one eye.
It's all a garden now. I've plants and trees and flowers from all over the Six Duchies and beyond. Monkey-tail vine from Jamalia, and blue-needle bush from the Spice Isles, and a lovely herb knot in the very middle of where it used to be. You'd like it, Tom. You will like it, when you come to live with me.
I'm sure I'll like it, I said, scrupulously avoiding the topic of where I might or might not live. Shall I go on, or do you want to nap now? A gentle snore buzzed from Lacey's side of the bed.
Go on. I'm not the least bit sleepy. Go on.
But in the midst of my telling her how I had attempted to kill Regal, she dozed off. I sat still a time longer, waiting until her grip slacked on my hand and I could slip clear of her. I walked silently to the door. As I lifted the latch, Lacey raised up on one elbow. There was nothing wrong with her hearing, and I suspected that despite her crooked fingers, one could still find a blade up her sleeve. So I nodded to her, and left Patience sleeping as I slipped from the room. I went down to the guard's room and ate heartily. There is nothing like a steady diet of salt fish to make one appreciate bread and butter and cold roast fowl. My enjoyment of the meal was somewhat dampened by the knowledge that evening was drawing on. Guardsmen seemed always hungry, and no one made any comment when I carried off half a loaf of bread and a goodly wedge of cheese with me. From my meal, I went immediately to a storeroom, where I helped myself to a carry basket and two sausages. I added the loaf and cheese to the basket. I took my trove up to Chade's tower room. Thick had been there. He had done a cursory dusting of the table and mantel and set out a bowl of fruit. A little fire burned on the hearth. There was a small supply of firewood in the hod, a bundle of tapers on the table, and water in the barrel. I shook my head in wonder at the man. After all he had been through, he was home for one day and still remembered his old duties. I put half a dozen yellow and purple plums into my carry basket and nestled a bottle of Chade's wine between the bread and cheese. I was folding feverfew and dried willow bark into a twist of paper when I felt Chade nudge at my mind.
What?
I need to speak to the Queen, Fitz.
Cannot you use Thick instead? I was just on my way to the skill pillars.
This will not take long.
I will have to find a way to arrange quiet time with Queen Katrichan.
I have already contacted her through Thick. The message she sent back was, yes, immediately. If you go to her private sitting room, she will come to you shortly.
Very well.
You seem cross.
I am worried about the fool. I have some things here I'd like to take back to him, fresh fruit and herbs for fever.
I understand, Fitz, but this should not take long. Then you can sleep the night through, and go in the morning.
Very well.
I released our contact.
Very well. And what else could I have said?
He was right. Many of the thoughts Dutiful had conveyed to his mother would have been difficult for Thick to grasp, let alone pass on. I tried not to resent the time it stole from me. The fool would be fine, I told myself. He had been through the changes before, and who better than the black man to tend him? He had even told me that he needed time apart from me, time to think without watching the face of someone who had witnessed what had befallen you. Besides, it was better that I serve this duty than Nettle, I told myself sternly. She needed to be home with her family, and doubtless her family needed her there. I found a clean piece of cloth and covered the bread. I went down the long, dim stairs to wait upon the Queen. It did not take a short time. Chade and Dutiful were quarrelling, and Chade had attempted to steal a march upon the Prince by contacting the Queen first. He and the Prince were to board the ship to sail home tomorrow afternoon.
The Narcheska was to have come with them, but earlier in the day she had gone to Dutiful and begged that she might have 3 more months in the company of her family before she left them to come to Buckkeep. The prince had granted it to her, privately, without consulting Chade.
"Very privately," Chade seethed, and I wondered if he intended that I pass on to the queen that the asking of the boon and the granting of it had occurred in a setting of an intimacy of which the counsellor did not approve. "Very discreetly was this matter discussed between the prince and the Narcheska," was what I told her.
"I see," she replied,
and I wondered if she did. "As of yet there has been no public announcement. It is not too late for us to retract this permission. I fear it will throw all our plans awry if the girl is allowed to stay here. For one thing, it will mean that when she arrives, if she keeps her promise to arrive at all, it will be in the storms of winter rather than in time for the nuptials to be celebrated with the autumn harvest. The prince will be returning to his nobles without a bride, indeed with nothing visible to show for the time and expense of this expedition. If, as we have hoped, you planned to press for the dukes to declare him king-in-waiting, this will be a lackluster event to base it on. Tales of dragons rescued and dragon heads on hearthstones will mean little to nobles who have seen not so much as a scale of a dragon, let alone the bride and alliance won by such valour. And I fear the longer the Narcheska lingers among her women here, the harder they will make it for her to depart from them. Their reluctance to give her up has grown hourly. They mourn her as one going to her death, as vanishing from their world forever." When these thoughts had been delivered to the queen, she suggested to Chade, "Perhaps then it would be wiser to give her more time to bid her people farewell.
Please add many assurances that visitors will always be welcome, and that she will periodically return to visit there as well. Have you extended welcome to any of her clan who wish to accompany her? Not just to witness the wedding, but to stay on, that she need not feel so alone here."
As I passed her words on to Chade, I was reminded starkly of how alone Cotricken had been when she journeyed from the mountains, without so much as a personal maid to accompany her. Did she recall her early days of being alone in a foreign court where no one spoke her mother tongue or recognized her customs? It is a part of the difficulty. As I understand it, a woman's bond to her land is sacred. The women in line to rule their mothers' houses seldom leave their homeland at all. They live on it, die on it, and go back into it. All that goes into a woman or comes forth from her is expected to stay on her own lands. So no woman of power will travel with her when she comes to Buckkeep. Piotr will accompany her, and perhaps a couple of her male cousins. Archon Bloodblade will come, and a goodly number of leaders from other clans will come, to confirm the trade alliances they have formed with our visiting nobles. But she will not have an entourage of servants and ladies.
"I see," Cotricken replied slowly.
We were alone in her sitting-room. She had poured wine for us, and the glasses rested neglected on the low table. The room had been restored since last I saw it. As ever, Cotricken sought her peace in simplicity. A single flower floated in a low pottery dish, and the candles were shielded to a gentle glow. The candles released a calming perfume into the air, but Cotricken was tense as a treed cat. She saw me looking at her hands clenched on the edge of the table, and carefully relaxed them.
"Does Chade hear all that I say to you?"
she asked me softly. "No, he is not with me that way, not riding with me as Verity used to do. That takes a great deal of concentration, and demands a total loss of privacy of thought. I have not invited him to that, so he hears only what you tell me to say to him." Her shoulders lowered a trifle as she relaxed.
"Sometimes my counsellor and I are at odds. When we spoke through Nettle, well, it was difficult, for Chade and I were both being so circumspect, taking care not to involve her in matters far beyond her ability or need to understand. But now you are here."
She lifted her head slightly, almost she smiled.
"I take strength from you, Fitzchivalry. In an odd way, when you skill for me, you serve me as a queen's man."
She drew herself up straight.
"Tell Chade that in this matter the prince's word to his affianced one will not be compromised. If he feels winter is not an auspicious time for this wedding, then let us offer to postpone it until spring, when the crossing will doubtless be safer and more pleasant for the Narcheska. In the matter of the prince being hailed as king-in-waiting, well, that has always been up to his dukes. If he must bring home a woman as trophy for them to find him worthy of the title, then the title means little to me. He will, eventually, reign over them. It is my opinion that his kindness and consideration to his future bride may well strengthen this alliance rather than be seen as a weakness.
She paused, as if thinking, pinching her lips firmly together, then,
"Tell him that, please."
She took up her wine glass and sipped from it. "This is not wise, Fitz. Cannot you reason with her? The prince is besotted with Eliania. He must be made to see that it is more important to both their futures that he now gratifies the wishes of his dukes rather than his bride's mother. The sooner this marriage is a reality, the sooner they will see him as a man approaching kingship rather than a boy prince. He is far too impetuous, following the impulse of his heart when the good of the six duchies demands that only his head makes his decisions. Make her understand, Fitz, that we have spent the summer doing the Narcesca's will, and now it is time for his dukes to see that they still have his heart, and that their regard is more important to him than the well-wishes of the Out-Islands. I pondered his words for a moment, and then opened my eyes to the Queen's anxious gaze. "This is what Chade thinks," I said, and relayed the gist of the message. The subtlety was not lost on Cotricken.
"And what do you think, Fitz Chivalry?"
I bowed my head to her. "I think you are the Queen, and that Prince Dutiful will some day be King."
"Then you counsel me to ignore my counsellor's advice and give support to my son?"
"My Lady Queen, I am very glad that I do not have to give you advice in this area." She almost smiled.
"You do if I ask you for it."
I was silent for quite a time, thinking furiously.
"Is your chair uncomfortable?"
she asked solicitously.
"You shift as if it is full of fire ants."
I settled back into it resolutely. "I would find a way between, my lady. It would please his dukes if the prince were wed and an heir produced, but he is still very young, not even of an age to be a king in waiting. The nuptials and the title can perhaps wait. Let the Narcesca have her time with her mother and sister. I have been there and seen how power is wielded. Although Oeta is Narcesca still, for she is alive, for Eliania to depart will be as profound an abdication as when my father passed the crown to Verity. Some will dispute who should next inherit the title. While she is a presence there, she can make firm her younger sister's claim, and I think it would be in the Six Duchies' best interest to see that her line of the family remains securely in power. Our dukes can be placated in other ways. Trade is what will enrich their coffers, and the Narwhal and Boar clans are not the only ones interested in what we have to offer them. Throw wide the gates, invite their Kaemperors, their warrior leaders, men all, they will not scruple to leave their mothers' houses, if by doing so they can gain a trade advantage. Let that be what we celebrate this autumn harvest. Begin now to plan a harvest fest that will display for them the riches of our six duchies. Encourage the dukes to attend, with their families and nobles of their duchies. Celebrate the trade alliances now, and let the wedding be the capstone when it occurs. Cotricken leaned back in her chair and regarded me carefully.
And when did you learn to be so sagacious, Fitz Chivalry?
A wise old man taught me that diplomacy is the velvet glove that cloaks the fist of power. Persuasion, not force, works best and lasts longest. Make this alliance in the Duke's best interest, and they will be eager to welcome and honour the Narcesca when she arrives. I did not add that he had taught me that when he had been content to move behind the walls of Buckkeep and manipulate the throne unseen.
Would that he still recalled that? Tell him your thoughts, but phrase them as if they were mine.
I longed not to be a party to Chade's haggling with the Queen, but there was no way to avoid it. I witnessed more clearly than I wished the subtle way in which they wrestled for the power of the Farseer throne. Age and experience of the six duchies were on Chade's side. I winced as several times he insisted that it was her mountain upbringing that blinded Cotricken to the political necessity of showing the Out-Islands a strong will. I had known that Chade had amassed power to himself. I do not think he meant any ill. I believe that he genuinely felt that he fought for the best interests of the six duchies. Had I manipulated the power of the throne for that long, doubtless I too would have felt a proprietary right to it. At that time I saw too clearly that if Cotricken did not stand firm, Dutiful could inherit a hollow crown. And so, against my will, I began to make suggestions to Cytricken that would outflank Chade, and to throw my strength toward her side. It was not long before Chade was aware of it, I am sure, and yet the wily old badger only seemed to relish the game more as he heaped objections and possibilities ever higher. Night deepened and then ventured toward dawn. The old man seemed tireless in his arguments, but I was not. And I watched my queen's pallor grow. Finally, during a pause in a very convoluted argument in which Chade had been sorting dukes and out-islander kaimperas into sets and predicting where each group would side, my weariness got the better of me. "Just tell him no," I suggested. "Tell him the prince has given his word to his fiancée, and it will not be abrogated by you or by Chade. Tell him that if it is an error, it is the prince's error, and learning the consequences of errors is one of the best tutors that any young ruler can have." My throat was hoarse, and my mouth dry with talking. My head seemed too big and heavy for my neck, and my eyeballs to have been rolled in sand. I reached for the wine bottle to pour us each a little more, but as I extended my hand, Cytricken seized it in both of her own. I lifted my eyes to hers, startled. Her blue gaze burned, as I had never seen it blaze before. It made her eyes seem dark and a little wild.
"You tell him, Sacrifice. Do not say it comes from me. I wish you to tell him it is your decision. That as the rightful, if uncrowned, king, this is what you decree."
I blinked and stared.
I cannot.
"Why not?" The answer did not make me feel brave. If once I take that stance, I cannot step aside from it. If once I declare myself so to Chade, then I must ever guard that right, the right of final say, from him.
"Until Dutiful puts on his full crown?"
"Yes. My life would never be my own again.
This is the life that has always waited for you. This is your life, your own life, which you have never taken up. Take it up now."
"Have you discussed this with Dutiful?"
"He knows that I regard you as Sacrifice. When I told him that, he did not dispute it."
"My queen, I pressed the heels of my hands to my throbbing temples. I wanted to say I had never even considered such a role, but I had. I had come 2 breaths from it on the night King Shrewd died. I had been ready to step up and seize the power of the throne. Not for myself, but to guard it for the queen until Verity returned. I teetered on accepting the shadow crown she offered. Was it truly hers to give? Chade pushed into my thoughts. "It is late, and I am an old man. Enough of this. Tell her no." It was not hers to give. It was mine to take. "No, Chade. Our prince has given his word, and it will not be abrogated by any of us. If it is an error, it is the prince's error. And learning the consequences of errors is one of the best tutors that any young ruler can have."
Those are not the queen's words.
No. They are mine. A long absence of thought followed my words. I could feel Chade there. I could almost sense his steady breathing as he stacked up my words and considered them from every angle. When next he touched minds with me, I could feel his smile, and strangely the welling of his pride.
"Well, after 15 years, do we finally have a true Farseer on the throne again?"
I held my stillness, waiting, waiting for mockery, or challenge, or defiance.
"I shall tell the prince that his decision has been confirmed, and extend our gracious invitation to all the out-islander kaimperas. As you will, King Fitz."
Chapter 34. Commitments. Our loss is great, and all for the foolishness of a wager between novices no wiser than children. By order of Skillmaster Treacney, all markings will be removed from the witness stones. By order of Master Treacney, it is forbidden for any skill candidates or novices to go to the witness stones unless the Skillmaster accompanies them. By order of Skillmaster Treacney, all knowledge of the use of the witness stones is hereafter restricted to those who are candidates for master status. Recovered skill scroll. When I climbed the hidden stairs back up to Chade's tower room that dawn, I was beyond weariness. I could not seem to find a coherent thought of my own. Chade and Prince Dutiful would be on their way home by this afternoon. The invitation to the Harvest Fest would have been passed to every Kaempra of every clan. Katrikan would have to set in motion the preparations for the grandest celebration that had ever been held in Buckkeep Castle. The invitations to the dukes and their nobles, the food, the guest housing, the minstrels and jugglers and puppeteers to be hired. It made my head spin, and I longed to lie down and sleep. Instead, once in my room, I added a few sticks of dry wood to the failing embers in the hearth. I filled a ewer with water from the barrel, and then poured it into the old washbasin and plunged my face into it. I came up, rubbed at my eyes until they felt less sandy, and then wiped my face dry. I looked into the small glass Chade had always kept there, and wondered who it was looking back at me. I suddenly understood what the fool had said to me earlier. I had journeyed to a place and time I had never foreseen, one past my death. Futures I had never imagined loomed before me, and I had no idea which one I should aspire to. I had taken a step toward claiming a throne, in essence, if not in view. I wondered if that meant that I had pushed any life with Molly out of the possible futures I might claim. Chivalry's sword rested where I had left it, above the hearth. I took it down. It fitted my hand as if made for it. I flourished it aloft and then asked the empty chamber, "And what would you think of your bastard now, King Chivalry?" "But I forget. You never wore the crown either. No one ever called you King Chivalry." I lowered the point of the sword to the floor, conceding to fate. Nor will anyone ever bow the knee to me. All the same, I think I will leave some sign of my passage. A strange trembling passed through me, leaving calm in its wake. Hastily I restored the sword to its place and then wiped my sweaty palms down my shirt front. A fine king, I thought, wiping sweat down his guard's uniform. I needed some sleep, but not yet. King Fitz, the bastard monarch. I made a decision and refused to think any more on it. I added a bottle of good brandy to my basket, covered it with a napkin, took up a heavy cloak and fled. I left the secret corridors behind me and departed by the guard's entrance. I had to pass the kitchens and almost I stopped to eat. Instead I helped myself to a little loaf of sweet morning bread from the guard's mess and ate it as I walked. I passed out of the gate with no more than a sleepy nod from the lad on watch there. I thought how I might change that and then pushed the thought aside. I strode on, diverted from the main road down to Buckkeep Town, onto the trodden trail that went first through the woods and then across the gentle roll of a hill. In the early light of day, the witness stone stood stark against the blue sky, awaiting me. Sheep cropped the grass around them. As I approached, they regarded me with that lack of curiosity that is sometimes confused with stupidity. They moved away slowly. I reached the witness stones and walked a slow circle around them. 4 stones, 4 sides to each stone, 16 possible destinations. How often had they been used over the years? I stood on the hilltop and looked out around me. Grass and trees, and there, if one looked for it, the indentation of an ancient road. If there had ever been the rubble of houses here, it had long ago been swallowed by the earth, or more likely carted off to rise again as a hut elsewhere. Hands behind my back, I studied the stone faces. I decided the runes had been deliberately effaced, long ago. I wondered why, and suspected I would never know. And that was almost a comfort. The basket on my arm was growing heavy, and the sun was warming me too well. I slung the heavy cloak around my shoulders. It would be cold where I was going. I stepped up to the face of the pillar I had emerged from on my last journey, set my hand to it, and passed through. I stumbled a bit as I emerged into the pillar room. Then dizziness took me, and I sat down flat on the dusty tiles until it passed. Not enough sleep, and using the stones twice in too short a period of time. Not good, I told myself firmly. Not wise. I tried to stand up, and then decided to sit down again until the tower stopped spinning. It took several moments of sitting there before I realized something obvious. The floor was no longer cold. I put both hands flat against it, as if to prove it to myself. It was not exactly warm, it was more neutral, neither warm nor cold. I stood and noticed that the windows were losing their haze of thick frost. I thought I heard whispering behind me, and turned quickly. No one was there. Perhaps it was an errant summer wind, a warm wind from the south sweeping the island. Very peculiar. I had no time to dwell on it. I left the pillar room, and basket on my arm tried to hasten through the icy labyrinth. My head pounded. I had not imagined the change in temperature. In one corridor, water slipped over the stones of the floor in a shallow, running flow. The gentle warming of the chambers and halls lessened and then ceased as I approached the juncture where stone walls met ice. Little black spots danced before my eyes. I stopped and leaned my brow against the icy wall and rested. The spots receded, and slowly I felt more myself. The coolness seemed to help. By the time I emerged from the crack in the ice wall onto the narrow path down to the black man's cavern, I had my cloak wrapped well about my basket and me. I made my way down the steep path and knocked again at the black man's door. No one answered. I knocked again, hesitated for a time, and then tried the string latch. The door swung open, and I entered. It took a moment for my eyes to adjust to the dim room. The fire had burned low. The fool was sleeping heavily on a pallet made up near the hearth. There was no sign of Prilcop. I shut the door quietly, put my basket on Prilcop's low table, and took off my cloak. Silently I moved to the fool's side, and crouching down, peered into his sleeping face. The darkening of his skin was already apparent. I wanted to wake him and ask him how he was. Sternly I resisted that impulse. Instead, I unloaded the basket, finding a wooden platter for the bread and cheese and a basket for the fruit. Prilcop's water barrel was nearly empty. I put water on to heat for tea, and then took his buckets out and down to the place where the trickle down the rock face came to a slight overhang and fell free. I waited while they filled and then hauled them up again. By that time the water was hot, and I made fragrant spiced tea. I think the aroma of the tea was what woke the fool. He opened his eyes and lay still, staring at the awakened fire for a time. He did not move until I said, "Fool, are you any better?" Then he gave a small start and turned his head sharply toward me as he jerked his body into a protective ball. I was sorry to have frightened him, and well understood that reflex. I made no comment on it, only saying, "I've come back and brought food with me. Are you hungry?" He pushed his blankets back a little and half sat up, and then sagged back down into his bedding. "I'm getting better. The tea smells good." "No apricots, but I brought you plums."
"Apricots?"
"I thought your mind was wandering a bit when you asked me to fetch you apricots. The fever, you know. Still, if there had been any to hand, I'd have filched some for you."
"Thank you,"
he said, then staring at me.
"You look different, more than just being clean."
"I feel different, but the clean helps too. I wish I could have brought the Buckkeep steams with me for you. I think they do you good. But as soon as you can walk at all, I'll get you home. I've told Catrickan that we'll be putting you up in Chade's old tower room for a time, until you've completely recovered and decided who you'd like to become next."
"Who I'd like to become?"
He made a small sound of amusement. I could not find the right sort of knife for cutting the bread, so I contented myself with tearing off the end of the loaf for him. I took him bread and cheese and a plum, and when the tea had finished steeping, poured him a cup. "Where's Prilcop?" I asked, as he sipped at his tea. I was a bit annoyed that he had left the fool here alone.
"Oh, out and about. He has been investigating the Elderling stronghold to see what damage has been done to it. We've had more time for talk while you were gone, in the moments when I was awake. There were not many, I think. He told me tales of the old city. They seem interwoven with my dreams. I suspect that is where he is now. He spoke of seeing what damage she had done and what he could put right. I suspect he did things to make the city less hospitable in hopes of driving her out. Now he plans to undo them. I asked him, for whom? And he said, perhaps just for the sake of putting it right. He lived there alone for many years after all the others died. For generations, perhaps. He did not tally the passing years, but I am convinced he has been here a very long time. He welcomed the pale woman when she first arrived, for he thought she had come with her catalyst to fulfill Prilcop's goals."
He drew breath and sipped at the tea. "Eat first and then tell stories," I suggested to him.
"Tell me yours while I eat. Something momentous has happened to you. It's in your bearing and eyes."
And so I spoke to him, as I could have to no other, divulging all that had befallen me. He smiled, but it seemed weighted with sadness, and nodded to himself as if I were but confirming things that he already knew. When I had finished, he tossed his plum pit into the fire and said quietly,
"Well, it is nice to know that my last vision and prophecy was a true one. So, I'll live happily ever after, as the minstrels sing." He twisted his mouth at me and shook his head. "You'll live among people who love you and have expectations of you. That will make your life horribly complicated, and they will worry you sick half the time, and the other half annoy you and delight you." He turned away from me and took his cup and looked into it, like a hedge witch reading tea leaves. "Fate has given up on you, Fitzchivalry Farseer. You've won. In the future that you now have found, it's almost likely that you'll live to a ripe old age, rather than that fate will try to sweep you from the playing board at every opportunity." I tried to lighten his words. I was getting a bit tired of being hauled back from death's door and beyond every time I turned around. "It's nasty. I know how nasty now. You've shown me that." He almost had his old smile as he asked me, "Let's leave it at this and call it even, shall we? One time pays for all?" I nodded. Then, as if he had to say it swiftly before I interrupted, "Prilcop and I have been talking about what should happen next." I smiled. "A new plan to save the world, one that doesn't involve me dying quite so often? One that doesn't involve you at all," he said quietly. "You could say that we are going home, after a fashion. Back to the place that shaped us. You said no one there would remember you, that there was little point to going back there." I was starting to feel alarm. "Not to the home that birthed me, I am sure I am no longer recalled there, but to the place that prepared both of us to face our destinies. It was a sort of school, you might say. I know I've spoken of it to you and told you, too, that I ran away from it when they refused to recognize the truth of what I told them. There, I will be well remembered. And Prilcop also. Every white prophet who has ever passed through there is well remembered. So let them remember you there. It seems to me they did not treat you well. Why go back? To see that it never happens to any child again, to do what has never been done before, to return and interpret for them the old prophecies in light of what we now know, to expunge from their libraries all that the pale woman planted there, or at least to cast it in a different light, to bring back our experiences of the world to them." I was silent for a long time. "How will you get there?" "Prilcop says he can use the pillars. Together we could travel quite a way south before we needed to find another way to travel. We'll get there, eventually." "He can use the pillars?" I was stunned. Why did he remain here in cold and privation all those years? The fool looked at me as if it were obvious. "I think he can use them, but he dreads them. Even in our language there are elderling concepts he has difficulty in explaining to me. The magic that makes the pillars work takes something from you each time you use it. Not even the elderlings use them casually. A courier of an important item might use one or even two pillars to travel, but then the task was passed on to another. But that is not the whole of why he stayed. He stayed to protect the dragon, and to await the coming of the White Prophet and the Catalyst, the ones he had seen who could, perhaps, finish his task. That was, after all, the focus of his life. I cannot imagine such devotion."
"Cannot you?"
"I think I can." I heard the scrape of the door and Prilcop entered. He looked startled to see me there, as well he might, but then exclaimed something to the fool. The fool translated, "He is amazed to see you return here so soon, and asks what pressing business had led you to brave the pillars again." I made a dismissive gesture and spoke to Prilcop. "I wished to bring food for you. See, here is bread and cheese as you wished, and wine and plums. I had hoped to find you both ready to travel to my home with me. But the fool still seems weak."
"Travel to your home with you?"
he asked me, and I nodded, smiling. He turned to the fool and spoke softly to him at length in their tongue. The fool replied more briefly. Then he turned and spoke reluctantly to me.
"Fitz, my friend, please, come and sit with me by the fire. I need to talk to you."
He got up stiffly, draped a blanket loosely around his shoulders, and moved slowly to a grass cushion by the hearth. He eased himself down onto it, and I took one beside him. Prilcop was investigating the food. He broke off a piece of cheese, put it into his mouth, and then closed his eyes in sheer pleasure. When he opened them again, he bowed his head in thanks to me.
I nodded back, pleased to have pleased him. When I turned back to the fool, he took a deep breath and spoke.
Prilcop does not intend to go back to Buckkeep with you. And neither do I.
I stared at him, running his words through my mind over and over. They made no sense. But why? His task here is finished, as is yours. Why remain in such a harsh place? It's cold, and this is summer. Life is hard here, and barren. When winter comes, I cannot even imagine wintering here. There is no reason for you to stay here, none at all, and every reason in the world for you to come back to Buckkeep. Why would you want to stay here? I know you wish to return to your school, but surely you could come to Buckkeep first, rest and recover for a time, and then take ship from there. He looked down at his long hands held loosely in his lap.
I have discussed this at length with Prilcop. There is so much that neither of us knows about this situation, this living beyond our time as white prophets. He has experienced it longer than I have. He stayed here because it was the last place he had a vision of himself. He stayed in the hopes that his final view of another prophet and catalyst coming to finish his task was true, and it was. His last vision was true.
He looked into the fire and then leaned over to push the end of a piece of driftwood deeper into it.
I had a final vision, too, of what would be after my death.
I waited.
I saw you, Fitz. I saw you in the midst of what you are currently becoming. It did not seem to me that you were always happy, but I thought you were more complete than before.
What has that got to do with it?
It has to do with what I did not see. I was, of course, to be dead. I had seen clearly that my death was a part of your future. No, that sounds cruel. As if my death were a thing you had planned. Rather say that my death was a landmark on the journey to where you had gone. You had passed my death and gone on to that life.
I did pass your death, but as you have told me so often, I am a catalyst. I brought you back.
Yes, you did. I had never foreseen such a thing. Neither had Prilcop. And in all the records we studied and memorized when we were in training, there is nothing that either of us can recall that foreshadows such a thing.
He almost smiled.
I should have foreseen that only you could work such a change.
A change that may have carried us outside of any future that any white prophet has ever foreseen.
But, I began, and he lifted that long, cautioning forefinger to halt me. Prilcop and I have discussed this. Neither of us thinks I should risk being around you too much. I could make a serious mistake. There is far less chance of my making a mistake if I do not go back with you.
I don't understand. A mistake? What mistake? You're feverish still and not making sense.
I was worried and irritated at the same time. I shifted angrily, and he reached out a hand and set it on my arm. His touch was almost cool. He was still weak from his changing time, but he did not speak from fever. His voice was almost stern, as if he were an old man and I were a willful youngster.
Yes, you do. You understand. You don't want to look at it, but you know it. You are still the changer, still the catalyst. Even in the short time you were at Buckkeep, you've proved that. Change is swirling around you like a whirlpool. Restored, you no longer flee it, but seem to attract it, and I am blind now when it comes to seeing what vast changes my influence upon you can cause. So,
he was silent for a time. I waited him out. I will not be coming with you.
No, wait, don't speak.
Let me talk for a time.
But instead of speaking, he immediately fell silent. I sat and looked at him and thought how he had changed. The pale moon-faced boy, the lithe and narrow youth, was now visibly a young man. Recent privation had sharpened the angles of his face, and the bruises around his eyes from his torment were still fading. But that was only his body. His glance had darkened, and his solemnity did not seem a temporary mood, but a new gravity of spirit.
I let him take his time as he mentally sorted his words. I suspected he was working on a decision, and that however resolute he might claim to be, his heart still teetered on a choice.
Fitz, I faced my death, not bravely, perhaps, but determinedly, because I had seen what might come after it and judged it worth the cost. I decided to come to this island and set in motion the events that would end with the dragon rising. I knew I would die, horribly, in pain and cold. But I also saw the chance for the world to know dragons again, a chance for there to be creatures as arrogant and lovely as humans, so that they might balance one another. I dreamed of a world in which men could not dominate all nature and impose their order upon it. It will not be a peaceful world, and it may be that men will curse me for my role in what happened here, but it will be a world in which both men and dragons are so busy with one another that they cannot subvert all nature to themselves. That was what I saw, in the greater scheme of things.
Fine. I was weary of his talk of dragons, and uneasy still about what we had loosed on the world. So now there will be dragons, lots of them, from what I saw happening over the battlefield. But why can't you come back to—
Hush! He rebuked me sternly. Do you think this is easy for me? Do you think that lofty reason is my only one? Do you think it is easy for me to part my ways from yours? No. There is a more personal element that divides my path from yours. It is because of what I glimpsed on a far smaller scale. I saw you, after my death, taking satisfaction in the things and people you had so long denied yourself. Living the life you were meant to have after my death, you gave me another piece of life. Shall I use it to rob you of yours? More slowly, he added, I can love you, Fitz, but I cannot allow that love to destroy you and what you are.
He rubbed at his face wearily, and then exclaimed in annoyance at the skin that peeled away beneath his fingers. He shook the bits from his fingertips, rubbed his face all over vigorously, and then folded his hands into his lap and looked into the fire. I glowered at him, baffled and waiting. Behind us, Prilkop moved quietly around the room. I heard a clicking sound and glanced behind me. He had opened the neck of a little sack and was taking small blocks of stone out of it. I recognized it at once. Memory stone, cut into uniform cubes like the ones I had glimpsed in the Elderling chamber. I watched as he held one briefly against his temple, then smiled and set it aside. He repeated the process, and again. It was soon apparent to me he was sorting the blocks into different stacks. He looked up, realizing the fool and I were watching him. He smiled and held up a cube of stone.
Music.
Another cube.
Some poetry.
Another cube.
History. Music again.
He proffered one to me, but I waved it aside, uneasy. The fool, however, reached out to touch it lightly with one skilled fingertip. He recoiled from it as quickly as if he had been burned, but then smiled at me. Music indeed. Like a rushing flood of it. You should try it, Fitz.
We were talking, I reminded him quietly, about you coming back to Buckkeep with me.
No. We were talking about me not coming back. He tried a smile that failed. I just looked at him. A short time later he said something, a request to Prilkop. At almost the same moment I felt Chade target my thoughts. I would speak to the Queen. I can't right now. Try thick. You know all the reasons why that will not work. Please, Fitz, it will not take long. That is what you said last time. Besides, I am nowhere near the Queen. I went through the pillar. I'm with the fool.
What? Without warning any of us or consulting with us at all? I believe my life is still my own.
No. It was a flat denial from Chade. No, it is not, sir. Last night you drew a line with me, and I sensed you did it with the Queen's approval. You cannot claim that authority one moment, and then shoulder aside from it the next. Crowns cannot be doffed so lightly.
I am not truly the King, and you know it. Too late to take that stance, Fitz.
Chade sounded angry. Too late. The Queen offered you the authority, and you accepted it. I did not capitulate. I could not decide if I agreed with him or not. Give me some time. By now you must be at sea. What can be of such immediate importance now that you have sailed? It will keep for a time, that is true. But after this, Fitz, you must not absent yourself without warning all of us. Am I a servant, that my time is never my own? Worse, you are a king, and sacrifice to all. He broke his mind free of mine before I could reply to that at all. I blinked and realized that I had just heard the door close. Prilkop had left. The fool was looking at me, somehow aware I had been skilling, and waiting for my attention to come back to him. Ah, I am sorry. Chade, in a rush as always, demanding that he needed contact with the Queen. He claims that if she has recognized me once, even for a moment, as sacrifice, that I now have all the duties and responsibilities of a crowned king. It's ridiculous. Is it? You know it is. My defense seemed to release a torrent of words from him, as if while he waited the words had mounted up inside him like water behind a dam. Fitz, go back to that life you were meant to have, and love it without reserve. That was what I saw you doing. He gave a laugh that had a hysteria at the edge of it. It even sustained me while I was dying. To know that you would go on to that life after I was dead. When the pain was worst, I fixed my thoughts on what I had seen for you, and I let it move through me. But she said you called out for me when she tormented you. I said the words, and then wished I could call them back. He suddenly looked sick and old. Probably I did, he admitted. I have never claimed to be brave. But the fact that she could wring that from me changes nothing, my friend, nothing. He looked into the fire, as if he had lost something there, and I was ashamed that I had taken him back to his torture. No man should be reminded that he has screamed in front of people who delighted in it. It should probably serve to teach me that, in many ways, I am not as strong as I wish I were. And I should not put myself in a position in which my weakness could damage both of us. He suddenly took my hand. It startled me, and when I looked at him, our eyes locked. Fitz, please, do not tempt me to follow you and interfere in the future I saw for you. Do not tempt me to step out of my time and try to take something that was never meant for me. He shivered suddenly. As if a chill had taken him, he let go of my hand and leaned closer to the fire, holding his hands out to them. The nails had just started to regrow. He rubbed his hands together, loosening a layer of skin like white ash. The new skin exposed beneath reminded me of polished wood. Very softly he asked me, "Could you have been content to live with Night Eyes among the wolves?" "I would have been willing to try," I said stubbornly. "Even if his mate could never completely accept you? Could you, for once, just say simply whatever it is you were trying to say?" He looked at me and rubbed his chin as if he were truly considering it. Then he smiled sadly. "No, I can't. Not without damaging something precious to me." As if he were not changing the subject at all, he asked, "Will you ever tell Dutiful that your body fathered his?" I did not like him to speak that aloud, even when it was just we two. My strong skill bond with Dutiful made him seem ever close. "No," I said shortly. "He would see too many things differently. It would hurt him, to no good end. It would damage his image of his father, his feelings toward his mother, even his feelings toward me. What purpose could it serve?" "Exactly. So you will always love him as a son, but treat him as your prince. One step away from where you long to be, because even if you told him you could never be his father." I was starting to get angry again. "You are not my father." "No." He stared at the fire. "And I'm not your lover, either." I felt suddenly weary and sour. "Is that what this is about? Bedding with me? You won't return to Buckkeep because I won't bed with you?" "No!" He did not shout the word, but something in the way he said it stunned me to silence. His voice was low, almost harsh, as he spoke.
"Always you bring it back to that, as if that is the only possible culmination of love."
He sighed, and abruptly settled back in his chair. He looked at me speculatively, and then asked,
"Tell me, did you love Night Eyes?"
"Of course. Without reserve?"
"Yes." "Then by your logic, you wished to couple with him?"
"I wished..." "No."
"Ah,
but that was only because he, too, was male. It had nothing to do with your other differences." I gaped at him. A moment longer, he managed to keep his face straight in honest inquiry. Then he laughed at me, more freely than I had heard him laugh in a long time. I wanted to be offended, but it was such a relief to hear him laugh, even at my expense, that I could not. He caught his breath and said,
"There it is, plainly, Fitz. I told you I set no limits on my love for you. I don't. Yet I never expected you to offer me your body. It was the whole of your heart, all for myself, that I sought. Even though I've never had a right to it, for you gave it away ere ever you saw me."
He shook his head.
"Long ago, you told me that Molly would never be able to tolerate your bond with the wolf, that she would force you to decide between them. Do you still believe that?"
"I think it likely," I had to reply softly.
"And how do you think she would react to me?"
He paused for a heartbeat.
"Who would you choose, and what would you lose either way by being forced to make such a choice? Those are the questions I've had to ponder, and if I come back with you and make that choice a part of your future, what else will my catalyst change in the process of choosing? If you left the six duchies with me, what future would we have set in motion, all unknowing?"
I shook my head and looked away from him, but the flow of his words was relentless, and my ears heard them.
"Night Eyes chose. He chose between the pack of wolves that would have accepted him and his bond with you. I do not know if you ever discussed with him what that decision cost him. I doubt it. The little I knew of him makes me think he chose and went forward from there. I do not mean to shame you. But is it not true that Night Eyes paid a higher toll for your bond, for the love that you shared, than you did? What did it cost Night Eyes to be bonded to you? Answer honestly."
I had to look aside, for I was ashamed. It cost him living with a pack, and being a wolf in full. It cost him having a mate and cubs, just as Rolf later warned us, because we set no limits on our bond.
"You knew the exhilaration of sharing his wolfness with him, of being as close to becoming a wolf as a man can get. Yet, forgive me, I do not think he ever sought the human within himself as ardently as you pursued being a wolf."
"No." He took my hand again and held it in both of his. He turned it over and looked down at the shadows of his fingerprints that I had worn on my wrist for so many years.
"Fitz, I have thought long on this. I will not take your mate and cubs from you. My years will be long. By comparison, you have not that many left. I will not take from you and Molly whatever years may remain to you, for I am sure that you will be together again. You know what I am. You have been within this body, and I in yours, and I have felt, oh, gods, help me against that memory. I have felt what it is to be human, fully human, in the moments that I held your love and pain and loss within me. You have allowed me to be as human as it is possible for me to be. What my teachers took away from me, you restored tenfold. With you, I was a child. With you, I grew to manhood. With you, just as Night Eyes allowed you to be the wolf."
His voice ran down, and we were left sitting in silence, as if he had run out of words. He did not release my hand. The touch sharpened my awareness of the skill bond between us. Dutiful nudged at my skill, seeking my attention. I ignored him. This was more important. I tried to grasp exactly what the fool feared. "You think that it would hurt me if you came back to Buckkeep? That it would keep me from a life you had seen?"
"Yes."
"You dread that I would grow old and die, and you would not?"
"Yes."
What if I didn't care about those things? About the cot? I still would. I asked my last question, my heart squeezed with hurt, dreading however he might answer it. And if I said I would follow you then, leave my other life behind and go with you? I think that question stunned him. He drew breath twice before he answered it in a hoarse whisper. I would not allow it. I could not allow it. We sat a long time in silence after that. The fire consumed itself. And then I asked the final, awful question. After I leave you here, will I ever see you again? Probably not. It would not be wise. He lifted my hand and tenderly kissed the sword-calloused palm of it, and then held it in both of his. It was farewell, and I knew it. And I knew I could do nothing to stop it. I sat still, feeling as if I grew hollow and cold, as if Night Eyes were dying all over again. I was losing him. He was withdrawing from my life, and I felt as though I were bleeding to death, my life trickling out of me. I suddenly realized how close to true that was. Stop! I cried, but it was too late. He released my hand before I could snatch it back. My wrist was clean and bare. His fingertips were gone. Somehow he had taken them back, and our skill thread dangled, broken.
I have to let you go, he said in a cracked whisper. While I can, leave me that, Fitz, that I broke the bond, that I did not take what was not mine.
I groped for him. I could see him, but I could not feel him. No wit, no skill, no scent, no fool. The companion of my childhood, the friend of my youth, was gone. He had turned that facet of himself away from me. A brown-skinned man with hazel eyes looked at me sympathetically. "You cannot do this to me," I said.
"It is done," he pointed out.
"Done." His strength seemed to go out of him with the word. He turned his head away from me, as if by doing that he could keep me from knowing that he wept. I sat, feeling numbed in the way that one does after a terrible injury.
"I am just tired," he said, in a small, quavering voice. "Just tired, still, that is all. I think I will lie down again."
"Fitz, the Queen wants you,"
Thick pushed effortlessly into my mind. "Shortly. I am with the Fool right now."
"It's about old blood. Soon, please," she says.
"Soon," I replied dully. And no sooner was Thick cleared from my mind than Chade was tapping at my shoulder. I gave him my heed and, "As long as you are there, think to bring back at least some of the skill scrolls you found there. We'll be in need of them, I think." "Chade, I will. Please. A time to myself. Please." "Very well." His reply was surly. Then he softened, asking more gently, "What is the problem? Is he that ill?" "Actually, he seems improved. But I need a time for my own thoughts." "Very well." I turned back to the Fool, but he had either sunk into a true sleep or was pretending one so convincingly that I could not find it in me to try to wake him. I needed a time to think. I thought there must be some way to get him to change his mind, if only I could think of it. "I'll be back," I told him, and then slung my cloak over my shoulders and went out. I thought I might as well make a trip through the Elderling maze to retrieve some of the skill scrolls. It would keep me busy while I thought. I have never done my best pondering while sitting still. I climbed the steep path and found I did not have to squeeze quite as much to get into the crack. My comings and goings were wearing it open, I thought to myself. Yet I had not gone far under the false light of the Elderling globes before I saw someone coming toward me. It startled me for the instant before I recognized the black man. He had a haunch of smoked meat on one shoulder, and as we